Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party Network. Me and Dallas have spent the past 2 weeks at the London Film Festival and have watched over 50 films between us in that time, and we've been really lucky to interview some of the talent involved at the festival and cover some red carpet premieres. You find a full list of the guests in the show notes for this episode and a rough time of when you can find them in this episode. Obviously, the adverts can throw things off by a few seconds either side. I'll introduce each interview with a brief synopsis to guide you as some of these films await a public release. First up, we have Simon Bird, best known to UK audiences as Will from The Inbetweeners. Simon has graduated to direct in his first feature film, Days of Bangold Summer, which sees a teenager spending a summer listening to heavy metal music and trying to get along with his librarian mum.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about your film and how you've gone from TV actor to first-time director?
Sure, yeah. So I made a film. It's called Days of the Bangold Summer. And it's based on a graphic novel which came out in 2011. It's about a teenage boy called Daniel who's a bit of a loner and a metalhead. And he thinks he's going to spend the summer holidays in Florida with his dad. But at the last minute his dad cancels, so instead he has to spend it at home with his mum Sue, who is a librarian and to him just the most boring person in the world. And it's about how their sort of relationship changes over that summer holiday.
And how did you come to direct this feature and stuff? Has it always been an ambition of yours to direct and move towards that?
Definitely, yeah. I'm a bit of a control freak, and I think I've always had my eyes on directing. And I started off by doing a short film a few years ago, and yeah, just worked my way up to doing this feature.
How do you sort of move from sort of, as you say, a control freak to, I suppose, as a director, we always think if someone's got a, you know, perfect vision, but to being able to delegate to producers, composers, and actors, is that a challenge for you, or is that especially doing a first feature?
No, I don't think so. Actually, I really enjoyed that. I think I knew that I'm not that up on sort of the technical side of filmmaking, so I really wanted to surround myself with people who knew what they were doing, and that's what I've always loved about working on TV and films. I think it's such a team effort. I just like being the manager of that team.
Of course. Comedy always seems to be such a, not an easy way, but a lot of people seem to graduate from comedy towards kind of directing. What is it sort of about comedy that seems to create that gateway that not many other sort of genres do for creative directors?
That's a really good question. I don't really know the answer, other than I think it's quite democratic and sort of egalitarian comedy. And I think you see people like, you know, anybody who writes a great sitcom usually has sort of just come up through the ranks and started off by just being funny with their friends and then doing stand-up, and you can sort of, I don't know, when I did The Inbetweeners, that was my first sort of, go at being in a TV show, and that was written and run by Ian and Damon, who to me were just like two normal men. They couldn't be more normal. They were just sort of basically like idiots. I mean, lovely idiots who sort of mucked around with us and were our friends. And they didn't feel like scary sort of boss figures or sort of people who had trained at film school for 10 years. They were just normal guys who happened to be really funny, and because of that were allowed to make a TV show. And once you're on set and you learn how it works, you sort of realise, oh right, anyone can do this. There's not, you know, there's no reason why it has to be closed off to them.
What's it like, for example, that as an actor, sometimes you go home at the end of the day, that's your job done, go home, do whatever you want, and then, you know, there's the publicity tours. Yeah. What's it like to sort of now have the post-production side? Was that something that you'd hadn't been exposed to much, or was this something kind of brand new for you?
No, I think that's exactly why I wanted to direct, is to sort of finally be involved in that sort of thing, because, like you say, in acting, you do your bit, and then you sort of forget that there's this whole other process to get the project finished. It can change so much in between your bit and the finished product. So I loved that. I loved the edit and the mix and the dub and all that sort of stuff. That was almost my favourite bit. Yeah.
What do you bring as a director for some? I mentioned things like Inbetweeners, Friday Nights, that you have, you know, a great comedy background. You're one of our kind of greats at the moment. What do you kind of bring to sort of that when you're directing kind of thing? Are you able to sort of share some of your kind of experience with the actors, or the sort of leaning on them, you know, you've hired the best people in a way?
Well, yeah, totally. I mean, on this I didn't, yeah, a lot of the time it's not necessary, and it wasn't that necessary on this because, like you say, we have brilliant people, you know, Rob Ryder and Tam and Greg and Monica Dolan, and you know, such a great cast. So they don't need to be told how to be funny.
Does that give you pressure or not when you've got like someone like Rob Brydon that's been with every sort of director, young and old and stuff? Do you think, am I on the right track here? You know, is he seen through?
Not really. I imagine with some actors it's probably good, and I bet there are lots of actors out there who are quite scary and intimidating, but Rob was just really nice, as was everyone in it, to be honest. So I never felt that pressure. I don't know what my sort of comedy experience really came to bear on this at all, to be honest. It's not really an out-and-out comedy like the stuff that I've been in. I think much more useful to me was just the experience of having filmed quite a lot, been on set a lot, and seen stuff go wrong and seen stuff go right, and sort of sort of instinctively knowing how to manage a filming day. I think that was the most useful thing for me.
So what's kind of next for the film? Obviously it's here at the London Film Festival just now. What's going to be its journey and its gestation period to being something that people will be able to see in cinemas or at home?
Your guess is as good as mine. I've never done this thing before, so we'll see. I mean, we just had a good start. We had our world premiere at the Locarno Film Festival last month, and now we're here, and we're in various other festivals coming up. So I think it's in good shape, and then at some point next year the distributors who are Altitudes will...
That's always an endorsement as well, having someone like Altitude. Yeah. You think of like cult films that they do and everything, they're like similar to like your A24's Annapurna's in a UK sense. Well, it's an Altitude film. This is going to be something from a unique point of view, and it's going to encourage young filmmakers, I always think.
Well, exactly, yeah, and they've been amazing so far. So I fully trust their wisdom, and they will come up with some sort of plan on when to release it next year.
Is it kind of exciting to be bringing it to the UK and stuff like that? You know, a UK film. How's it kind of played abroad, and how do you think it's going to play here with a home crowd, as it were?
Well, it was amazing. We were so happy to get into the Locarno Film Festival. Its world premiere was in Switzerland, and it had two sets of subtitles in French and in German. So I was a bit worried about how it would go down, because that's the biggest screen in Europe in Locarno, and there are 8,000 people there. So that was a real scary sort of first test. But it was great, and we had sort of laughs all the way through, and such a great response from people afterwards saying how much they enjoyed it. So that's given me hope that it can travel, and it's going to Tokyo and Moscow and various other places, so we'll see. But it is obviously first and foremost a British film, so I'm hoping that people in the UK will enjoy it as well.
We always seem to get behind our guys here, so thank you so much.
No worries,
really appreciate it. Good luck.
Robert Eggers follows up The Witch with The Lighthouse, the hypnotic and hallucinatory tale of two lighthouse keepers on a remote and mysterious New England island in the 1890s. Robert Eggers begins our red carpet interview by talking about the making of process and casting Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson.
It wasn't easy, but we knew that when we signed up for this. So it was challenging, and the scenes were really demanding, and the weather was terrible, so there wasn't a lot of like chumming around, but we liked and respected and cared for each other and supported each other and saw each other through. And Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson, incredible, and they just bring so much to every day. And I mean, if I said to the guys, you have to cut your hands off for the scene, Willem would have complained a little, but they both would have done it. because it's my second movie and they're Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe. They're not auditioning for me, but I didn't, like, but who else is supposed to play those roles? So there was no question. They, you know, and luckily they wanted to work with me before, so it was fast. Inspired by the past, I do a ton of research, and by trying to like stay locked in my study away with my head in the past, I think that sometimes people find what I'm doing to be unique because like my influences are dead, long dead.
I'm from the Northeast Scotland. I can say I can really sort of relate to Robert Pattinson's character and how he dealt with the circus. I have to ask, how was it working with the seagull, and how did you draw such a amazing performance out of it?
Believe it or not, it was played by three classically trained British seagulls. There's three seagulls in the UK named Lady, Tramp, and Johnny, and they collectively played our seagull. I had every seagull in the movie, actually, aside from the flying ones, which were in Cape Forshoe, where we shot. They knew that our crew was a film source, so they food source, so they stuck around. But anyway, the seagulls were incredibly intelligent, incredibly well-trained, incredibly easy to work with. They knew their stuff. They came in, they knocked it out. You know, great British actors.
I have to say that it'll play very well in Aberdeen. There'll be a huge cheer when the seagull gets his come up. I can tell you that.
Yeah, okay, good.
Robert, this is obviously your second film with A24.
Uh-huh.
What's the collaboration like between you two to create such unique films?
They just leave me alone.
Easy as that.
The collaboration comes in to the marketing.
After obviously the success of The Witch, what ideas did you have in your head, and how long did it take to settle on The Lighthouse, or was this always the second film?
It wasn't a matter of settling. I was, you know, it took 5 years since The Witch premiered at Sundance, and I was working around the clock every day on various scripts and developing things, and this is just what got greenlit.
Yeah. It's amazing to see that you've got the whole cast of The Witch here as well tonight.
That must be really special.
Has that bond kind of continued over the past 5 years? I know it's Black Phillips missing, but everyone else is here.
Yeah, I love him. Not Black Phillips.
Of course.
He's a nightmare.
I'm joined up next by directors Tyler Wilson and Michael Schwartz, who discuss their first feature, The Peanut Butter Falcon, the story of Zach, who runs away from his care home to make his dream of becoming a wrestler come true.
Obviously, this is your first feature. Was it always your ambition to make a feature film, and what was the process of bringing that to life?
I think I was a little untraditional in my approach to features, and I think Tyler was too. I don't know if we ever really wanted to be feature directors. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that I was more of an athlete growing up and wanted to do that, and then when I was making stuff like video for the first time, I just really wanted to be an editor, and mm-hmm. I loved commercials, and then grew to be enamored with longer stories and partnering with Tyler. We went from commercials to short films, and then features was the next mm-hmm. step, and now I'm madly in love with the form.
What's that kind of working relationship like between the two of you? I'm always interested. You always think of directors as one person with a singular vision. How do you sort of balance that out between the two of you?
It's a real gift. The balance of workflow is, for me, is you just pair somebody that's better than you. So Mike, you might want to answer that.
I mean, I would say the same thing. I think I pair with somebody that's better than me. I think we look after each other's blind spots. Mm-hmm. I think it's really common in film to think that you're smarter than everybody. And I think Tyler and I really recognize that we're not. And that we also care a lot. Mm-hmm. So I think if Tyler has a better idea than me or a better approach, we go with that. If I have a better idea, we go with that. Or if a producer or an actor has a better idea, we go with that. Mm-hmm. And it's our job to guide the story along.
Mm-hmm. When did this sort of story first kind of come to you, and how did you sort of, how long has it taken to get to this stage where you've had your premiere here in London last night? What's been the time scale of bringing this to life?
I mean, with The Peanut Butter Falcon, I'm realizing now it's closer to 6 years that we've been on this journey. We met Zach at a camp for people with and without disabilities mm-hmm. about 8 years ago, and knew him for a handful of years. And then he wanted to be a movie star. He told us one night at dinner, "I want to be a movie star." And we said, "Well, that's a challenge for anybody, yeah. but there you have Down syndrome. There's mm-hmm. not a lot of roles written for people with yeah. disabilities." And he's so optimistic and so confident in mm-hmm. himself as well. Yeah. He just said, "Cool, You guys write and direct it, and I'll star in it. We'll make it together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, through many hurdles, we've gotten here. We wrote the script with Zach for about a year, you know, taking a lot of his input. And then the inspiration for the story was Tyler grew up in the Outer Banks, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. We knew we wanted to make something with Zach, and it was, what did we think we could make
for free?
Yeah. So it was a lot of like, okay, we have friends with boats, we can do that. Mm-hmm. We know Zach likes wrestling. We want the character to have a range of real emotions, so let's work that in there. We like basically a character on a little bit of an outlaw, because that's common in a storyline in the Outer Banks where we could get the boats. And classic literature, I think there was a humor blend, humor with drama that Mark Twain did, that I think we were kind of looking into like for that tone as well.
Part of my day job, as it were, is I work with people with disabilities and health conditions. The thing that they always come back to me with saying is, you know, we help them find employment in the roles that they want to do. So someone comes to us and says, I want to be an actor. Okay, how do you achieve that?
Yeah.
Make it a realistic goal and target. And there's so much debate. People will always say, I just want a fair shot, you know. And what is it for yourselves? There's so much been debate and stuff of people sort of saying, oh, anyone can play anyone and all that sort of stuff. It should be free reign. How important is it for you as directors, especially first time, to go, well, we're giving people a fair shot. We're creating roles for people, as opposed to sort of, we'll take a celebrity or a Hollywood name and cast them as someone with a disability.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think Zach was really just the best actor that we knew. So it was for us, it was very focused. We thought that Zach was talented. We thought that Zach deserved a shot, and we wanted to work with him. And the ripple effects, we've come to know more about the community and representation. It's really exciting that our film might be opening doors for people. Yeah. And it, for us, you know, there's traditionally a lot of movies like Forrest Gump and What's Eating Gilbert Grape, and what's the Dustin Hoffman one?
Rain Man.
Rain Man.
The go-to one, people with autism, what I've found out in the past, people talk about it. Oh, I'm not like Rain Man and stuff, and it can have that negative connotation and stuff, whereas your film creates very much that positive discussion.
Yeah, we didn't want to do it like that. You know, we thought that Zach really was the best person for the job. And there were some conversations. You know, when you're making a movie, it takes a lot of resources.
Yeah.
And when people did read the script, and we made a proof of concept to sell the movie as well, sort of a short trailer. When people read the script and liked it, they did say, what movie star are you going to get to play this?
Yeah.
And we just said, no, like Zach. Mm-hmm. Zach is the star. Zach is the best person for this job.
And was studios open to that, or was there any sort of potential pushback?
I think we were always smaller than a studio movie, but financiers, some of them weren't open to it, and we moved on. And the guys that we did end up with were all about it. Chris LaMole at Armory Films has people in his family with Down syndrome, so I think he got it immediately. And our producers, Albert and Ron from Bonafide, they did Little Miss Sunshine in Nebraska. Yeah. Really got it as well. And then before we even got to them, we had Lige and Dave, two buddies of ours that were in to make it for $20,000 if it went that way, or, you know, and it obviously got bigger than that, and they stayed on as well.
You mentioned sort of the community, you know, how have they reacted to it, and what's been sort of the connection between the two films?
Oh, it's been, do you mean the community of like disabled?
Yeah, people? Of course.
Yeah. It's been great. Global Down Syndrome Foundation out of Denver, the Shrivers with Best Buddies and Special Olympics, and the Rudderman Foundation have all been really supportive. So it's been really nice to have them both as sounding boards. Yeah. You know, we do walk some tight ropes. You know, we use the R word, and it's, you know, from what we've heard in the community, it's important to show the hardship that people with disabilities go through to not sugarcoat that.
Absolutely.
You know, so we walked that road, but, you know, really made it clear that in everyday life, we don't like the use of that word. And then it's been great as we go out to screenings. You know, again, the ripple effect, I don't think we realized what a big impact this would have on the disabled community. We were at a Best Buddies conference in Indiana. There's like 3,000 people there. They're all going crazy and cheering. And, a mother of a son with Down syndrome came up to us after she saw the movie. She's crying, and she said, "You guys, like, I don't think you realize what you've done. My son just graduated college. He can't get a job. And I think if more people see your movie, he will be able to get a job. And it's not even a job as an actor, but just a job. And that's been really exciting to see that. I think we're getting up to, you know, 1 million people have seen the movie now.
Nice.
And that's some big impact. And that's just the United States. And as we come to the UK and Europe, it's exciting to think that millions of more people will see it and maybe have some space in their lives or space in their hearts to really embrace people with different abilities.
I mean, that's cinema and festivals at its finest, is watching a film and seeing people you know and love reflected back at you. And too often there's communities and people that do not see that representation. It feels your film is a real important step in reflecting that another community that's now getting representation on screen.
Yeah.
Obviously, you touched on Nebraska. You've got a fantastic cast as well. You've got people like Bruce Dern, Shia LaBeouf, Dakota Johnson. What was the sort of casting process like for this? And how does something like you're touching on, you've got this small film, you're getting this investment. How do you get these people that are synonymous with perhaps bigger names, blockbusters and franchises involved?
I think it came a little bit out of roadblocks. Tyler and I, you know, we didn't have agents or managers or any famous friends when we started. And we made that proof of concept that we mentioned a little bit earlier. And people saw Zach on camera and they saw the tone of the film in just that 5 minute clip, and almost everybody we showed that to just said, I want to make that movie. You know, Shia didn't even read the script. He just saw that video and FaceTimed us and said, guys, can I make this movie with you? Bruce Dern had made Nebraska with Albert and Ron, so there was a connection there. John Hawk's producer connection as well. John Bernthal was shy. I just called. We said, you know, who do you want to play your brother? And they'd made Fury together. And they had a real connection. So we were driving around in this old beat up truck, the truck that's in the movie. And Shy said, let me call Bernthal. And he was sitting in the back and he was on the phone. And he knocked on the window. Said, yeah, he's in, he'll be here in a couple of days.
That's amazing. It's like, it feels like you've got like a community behind the scenes, but also you can see that reflected in the film as well. How did you sort of build up that kind of relationship camaraderie between the sort of the cast?
I mean, it's the kind of guys we are, and I think it's Zach. Like, Zach comes in immediately. I think normal, your average guys, maybe you, me, I don't know, you come into a relationship and you go, we'll see how this goes. You could be a good guy, you could be a bad guy. I think Zach comes in loving everybody 100%, and it's disarming, it's inspiring. So I think Tyler and I are pretty loose guys. I think Zach's a leader, and you know, immediately Shia and Dakota and everybody fell in love, you know, just day one.
Nice. One of the things I was curious about as obviously first time filmmakers is, you always hear the thing of, don't work with kids, animals. And I was watching that going,
And water.
That's exactly it. Like, I'm thinking, I'm having flashbacks to like 90s documentaries where James Cameron's talking about making Titanic and the challenge with water. What was that like as on a practical level, as directors, like shooting on water, but also what surprised you about feature making in a positive, perhaps a negative sense?
Regarding shooting on water, I think Mike and I are pretty water people. So in some ways it was easier for us to work on water than land. I'd rather shoot on water than interiors.
Interiors are really tough. You gotta make it look
not lit. Water, you just like, we can't use lights. But so, you know, we shot stuff in the proof of concept of that sort of trailer that's still in the film and in the real trailer. Like, just that was just Mike and I and our buddy Dave and a camera and Zach, you know. So I think we're pretty talented. We're watermen, you know. It wasn't the dog was maybe more scary. I was more nervous to work with Shia than to work on water.
I know, it's quite great to see him back in sort of like, you know, in sort of the Transformers, but he's like a family movie and stuff that if you can bring everyone along to and stuff And, you know, he's always synonymous with these more, you know, more edgier sort of indie films, something like this. It was so great to see him in that. I thought it was a great showcase for his skills.
Yeah, I love him so much. I think he's so talented. It's funny, the first time we showed him the movie, we invited him into a screening room, he watched it, finished playing, he's like, that's good. It's the sweetest character I've ever played.
And
it's funny, I think Tyler said, you're an arsonist, you're a thief.
You've committed manslaughter, possibly. And somebody who punches children in the face. It's funny. I didn't realize we made a family film. Like, it's not a family film, but it kind of is. But as strange as it might sound, this was one of the most provocative films to come out this year that I've seen. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think, you know, we couldn't sell the film. We came out, distributors didn't want it. A lot of festivals wouldn't play it at first. You know, there's something about it. I think people are really scared about having somebody with Down syndrome or what's perceived as a disability being in a film and not treating him like coddling him. Yeah. I think people are really scared in this sort of culture we're living in to not coddle Zach. Yeah. And I think we're just kind of passing the precipice of that.
It feels the frustrating part, because you almost think the hardest part must be getting someone on screen, filming and making the movie. And then now that the challenge is, you think you've got this cast, you've got a film that's getting great reviews. Yeah. This should be the easier part now of going into the world, and the fact that there's maybe that resistance.
It was surprising. I mean, we won South by Southwest.
Yeah.
We had, you know, the cast that we've already discussed.
We were sitting at like 100%
of Rotten Tomatoes. 100% of Rotten Tomatoes, and we just heard from distributor after distributor, we don't think we can market A Hero with Down Syndrome.
Yeah.
And we're just like, how are you crazy? You're just crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're just wrong.
They just were like, you made a film that is unsellable.
Yeah.
And here we are now, and people, there's a lot of, you know, awards buzz for Zach and Shia in the film, and we made a couple bucks.
Yeah, that's the highest grossing platform release in the United States.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So what is the journey now for the film finally? Of like, now that here we are at the festivals, that's another banner.
Yeah.
Where's it kind of going to next, and where will people be able to kind of see it in Europe? And so you mentioned a platform release in America. If people listening over there, where can kind of people see it then?
So it's out in America. It's coming out October 18th in the UK. There's a roll out with too many dates for me to remember for the rest of the world.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's coming out in Spain. I think it's already out in Portugal. So it's over the next
Holland.
Yeah. Over the next handful of months, it will be available in many places, and then
go look for the film.
Google it. It's also interesting to know like how many people see it on DVD once it comes out. And just talk to the DVD people now. Still so many people see movies like that.
Oh,
so it'll be around for be around forever.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the best testament. But honestly, congratulations, guys, and all the best with what you're
really
doing as a film and the advocacy as well. It's much appreciated.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Joe Talbot, the co-writer and director of Last Black Man in San Francisco, joins us next. Last Black Man in San Francisco is about Jimmy Fails, dreaming of reclaiming the Victorian home his grandfather built in the heart of San Francisco. Joined on his quest by his best friend Mont, Jimmy searches for belonging in a rapidly changing city that seems to have left them behind. So Joe kicks off with discussing the reaction to the film.
We've been very lucky. I mean, the truth is, when we finished the film, we finished it 4 days before Sundance, before the premiere. And so we went into Park City, which is high above altitude, and we're all sort of, you know, I think anxious and nervous to put this thing out in the world that we've been working on for 5 years at that point. And I wish I could say that I knew how people would respond. I think we thought that we made something that captured the city that Jimmy and I love, but you really don't know until you put it out there. So it's been really wonderful to see how it's been received and to talk to people afterwards, to hear stories from people that lived in San Francisco, or frankly from people who've never even been to San Francisco before, but are finding this connection with Jimmy because, sadly, I think what's happening there is happening everywhere. That's been sort of this, it's both, as a filmmaker, it's rewarding, as a human, it's sad, because it means that we're all seeing the cities that raised us become less recognizable, and I think people that historically made those cities the special places they are, especially in San Francisco, which was a haven for artists, for people that didn't fit into their small towns from other conservative parts of the country, they arrived, you know, in San Francisco to be the person that they couldn't be elsewhere. And now the city that once welcomed those groups is driving many of them out in waves. And so, you know, I think it's nice that it can be a point of conversation, I think, for people that have lived in the city a long time. as well as people moving there, perhaps it'll give them a little more insight into what was there before them.
How did you go about bringing this to the big screen?
Jimmy and I grew up together in San Francisco, and so it's an unusual movie in that way. He's playing a character that shares his name, and a lot of the movie is pulled from his life. It's also pulled from the lives of friends of ours. We're both multi-generational San Franciscans, so we grew up on the stories of our parents' San Francisco and our grandparents' San Francisco. For me, a lot of that was in the 60s and the Haze. And for Jimmy, just down the street, it was the story of, you know, how his grandfather had built this house. And that was what he was raised to believe. And I think especially when things got dark and the family that had all been huddled under one roof living together was dispersed after they lost the house, Jimmy really held on to that story as something that carried a lot of weight for him, you know. And so the movie is not just about the house, but we also wanted to work through the idea of family stories and what they mean to us when we're going through difficult times.
It was I think in reflection now, a very unusual process. For us, it didn't feel unusual because it was the only one we've ever known. But I think it's not typically how movies get made. Part of that is, so it stems from, as I was saying, the conversations that Jimmy and I had growing up in San Francisco and wanting to turn those into a film. But what began with just the two of us quickly expanded in the early stages to this like film family that came together around the film. And part of that was that, you know, I'm a high school dropout. Jimmy has never acted in anything other than my film. So we knew that we weren't the most bankable pair in the world when we're saying, hey, do you want to give us a couple $1 million to make this movie? Most people in their right minds wouldn't trust us. And so we shot a very funky concept trailer early on that was essentially a very cheap version of the opening sequence of the movie where he skates through the city. But in our concept trailer, Jimmy was telling his grandfather's story that inspired the film. And I shot it and edited it and scored it, and we put it online. And it actually ended up being this accidental calling card where people started writing us, some from London actually, saying, like as I was saying, it's this universal story, and we hadn't been aware of that before. But for people that were a bit closer to San Francisco, we got a bunch of letters saying, how can we help make this movie? I mean, it really was like this kind of groundswelling around the film. I still meet people today that go, I haven't seen the movie yet, but I gave you $10 on Kickstarter. So it did really tip into something. We were fortunate. But I think, you know, the small group that formed around it, many of them were also Bay Area based artists who were struggling with the same things. How can I survive here? And they really threw all of themselves into the movie. It's one thing for me and Jimmy because we grew up together, but to have this group of people who are just meeting us for the first time, like devote so much of themselves to something, it really was an integral part of this film because not only was it difficult being a first film, but also San Francisco happens to be one of the hardest places in the entire country to make a film in. Very film averse, not a lot of funding in general in the U.S. for narrative films. But beyond that, it can be very expensive. And so, much like the wealth gap that exists in San Francisco, you know, outside of filmmaking, the movies that come there are often either huge Marvel films that go to blow up the Golden Gate Bridge, or they're tiny indie films that are sneaking under the radar made for like $200,000. And we lived in this precarious place where we're nothing close to the Marvel movies, but we had a little bit more than the very tiny indies. And so it was a constant struggle that took this Herculean effort from everyone involved to figure out how we could do something that was, for our budget, pretty ambitious. We had a lot of exterior shots, we had a big cast, kind of built this family that all developed the story together, so it was almost like a writer's room. As we were writing, we were scouting locations and casting. Uh-huh. So we found that for us, it was very helpful to do it that way because we'd find a location we loved and we would end up writing it into the movie. So, for instance, and I think initially probably in one of the first drafts when Jimmy goes to see his dad, cut immediately to an interior. But we found this beautiful building with this stay sign on it. And so then we built the scene with this opera singer outside who was someone else that we'd seen on one of our walks that we go on during our writing sessions, and we just start talking to him and he influenced his character. So I feel like I enjoy that way of doing it because I come from a family of journalists, and there was a sort of journalistic element to the research and the world building that we wanted to do, really trying to capture our San Francisco and archive it because it's changing so quickly. Like, half the locations in the movie are unrecognizable at this point now, and we just shot a year ago because it's changing that quickly. Like the housing projects, for instance, where Jimmy goes to the candy house in one brief scene and the woman who runs the candy house is arguing with the guy at the front of the line. Those are very famous housing projects in San Francisco called Double Rock, and they've since been torn down. The area all around Montgomery's house looks very different. There are still groups that are fighting day and day to keep San Francisco this special, strange place that it has been for many years. I think what they're coming up against now are incredibly powerful forces, right? The money, there's never been money quite like this in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Even old San Francisco money is freaked out, you know? The Pacific Heights crowd, which is like where the old money in San Francisco mm-hmm. was for a long time, I think they are not crazy about what's happening, which is kind of says a lot. It's tech. So San Francisco, you have outside of the Twitter headquarters, you'll find people with needles in their arms. And some tech workers who are moving there are probably appalled and want to understand what's happening. Mm-hmm. Many who you see, if you just were to go there on a random day and watch, will be stepping over people who are nodding off. Mm-hmm. And even worse, occasionally writing angry blog posts about the human feces on the ground. Rather than trying to understand who the human is that the feces came from, someone that may have lived in San Francisco long before you, may have even lived in an apartment that you were in and got pushed out themselves, it's like there's an apathy that I think is really invading the spirit of San Francisco. And it was not that way. Like, it used to be when we were growing up, I knew all the homeless people in my neighborhood. You see them around the park. They're a part of your community. They're not a nuisance. Now they're treated like this despicable thing that no one wants to touch or to engage with. And so people pretend that they don't exist. Someone can be shouting on the streets in need of help, or sometimes just looking for someone to talk to. People walk by like nothing's happening.
Did you have like any concerns as a white man telling this story about the black community in San Francisco?
I think when you're talking about historically black films that have been made by white directors, I think that it's really important. It's a good question to ask, like, what is this director's connection to the story, right? And so I think it's a totally reasonable thing. I'd probably wonder the same things if I saw the film and then looked it up and saw that I had directed it. I think that in our case, it's really important that it comes out of a collaboration. And so it's not just me coming in, helicoptering in, and telling the story that I don't have any connection to. Jimmy and I growing up together in San Francisco, having a trust that not only as like a white man and a black man, but also as people that have known each other for a long time, have shared very intimate stories with each other, long before we ever started thinking about, oh, we want to make a film. I think that connection was very critical because it's not just his experience, again, as an African-American San Franciscan. It's his actual life, right? Really imbued into the film. The scene with his mother is actually his mother. And they have a very specific relationship, So I think that, you should also ask Jimmy that question as well, because he can speak more to what that was like from his perspective. But from mine, it was important to really make sure that we were creating something together. And that went beyond just me and Jimmy. I think that extended to our whole team, which was a very diverse team. And, my other partner, other than Jimmy on the film, creatively, was my lead producer, Kalia.
Lovely.
So Kalia Neal is from Oakland, which is right across the bay. Her family and her mom's side's from Hunters Point, where Montgomery lives in San Francisco. And Kalia is someone that reached out and took a big risk on us very early on. I would love for Kalia to get more shout outs. If you guys are looking to write about a heroic producer, I mean, she reached out to us when we had very little recognition, long before A24 and Plan B came on, and helped us like actualize it. She was working with me in years for Isolation in San Francisco to figure out how we could turn this into a film. And Kalia is my producing partner. We made every decision together. And so I think it's important that like it's not just on Jimmy's shoulders to sort of like shoulder that whole experience, but really as a team, hoping that the way that we work collaboratively, developing the story together, making sure that all decisions feel like there's conversations around it, there's an openness, that that's like a part of the storytelling, so it's not just for me.
You bring this beautiful house, the skateboard, inanimate objects to life incredibly well in this film. How did you achieve this so that the audience becomes really invested in them?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, we would joke that Jimmy's skateboard is like his horse. You know, he's like a cowboy. He rides off into the sunset. Where he lays his hats is home. And when he breaks that skateboard, it's not just this inanimate object. It has deep meaning for him because historically, you know, and this is true in Jimmy's life as well outside the film, it's like the skateboard is your way into different parts of San Francisco that you might not otherwise go to. It's like San Francisco was sort of a skate mecca in the 90s and early 2000s when we were growing up. And when Jimmy started skateboarding, he said he saw different parts of the city than he knew existed. So that was, that held a special importance.
The cinematography and the music design in this film is incredible and really adds to it. Can you tell me a little bit about that as well?
Man, like I met two lifetime collaborators when we started making this film. One and Adam, our cinematographer. I met Adam 10 days before we shot the film. It was pandemonium. I had another DP who had shot a short that was going to do it. We lost him at the last second. And Adam stepped in and was a hero. I mean, we were shooting crazy long days and then shot listing at night when he should have been sleeping. He could have very well come in this like under great duress at the last minute and had every excuse to like carve out some time for himself to be a human being, but he's so deeply obsessed and focused on like wanting to make sure everything feels right. At one point when he and I were sort of like in the throes of like pre-production, it was getting scary, we're 2 days out, we were sort of going back and forth, and he stopped me and he was like, I just want to make sure that I really honor this story because I know you and Jimmy have been living with your whole life. And I think every bit of passion he brings to it is like comes out of that. Like it's a deep respect. So he's a special person. Really, really special. And Emil is similarly obsessive about his craft. Emil had never scored a feature film before. But he wanted to make a score that he felt was out of, he always says, Jimmy's heart. And so it's orchestral and almost like the music he wrote for the house, he always said he wanted to feel church-like with the organs that are built in there and it being this sort of holy place for Jimmy in some ways. So I feel so lucky. Those guys made my dreams come true, and I feel like they really, it's a hard thing on a small budget to shoot San Francisco in that way and to make it sound the way that Emil does. And there aren't many people that could have done that, even accomplished DPs and composers.
What's it like to be added to sort of the A24 filmography and their list of sort of first-time feature directors?
Yeah, A24, it's an honor. I mean, they take huge risks, you know, and they really, I think, want, like, directors. They empower directors to, like, tell the stories they want to tell. I think a lot of people say they do that, and very few do. So there aren't many people I could imagine making this movie if not them.
Actress Mirjana Di Giuliano talks about Emma, Pablo Larrain's latest feature, about a couple that deals with the aftermath of an adoption that goes awry as their household falls apart. Emma was one of my favourite films of the festival. I was wondering, when did you sort of first learn about the role of Emma? Was it when you pitched the character, or did you get your hands on the script?
Pablo called me and we had lunch, and he told me that he's going to make this film about a free woman and that I will have to cut my hair, and that's all that he said to me. And 1.5 months later, he called me and he said, I want you to be the Emma. No, because it doesn't have name. And we immediately start with the dancing process and training with Jose Vidal Company. He's a very known choreographer in Chile. And then with all the aspect of Emma, how she dressed, about the hair. And we didn't have a script. Maybe Pablo has one or an idea, but we only have these isolated scenes. They send it to us the night before or 2 days before sometimes.
Is that terrifying or exciting?
It was very terrifying at first, but at the end was very liberating, because I think that that's why this movie, it's my vision, is so fresh. We didn't have certainties.
There was no certainty.
About anything. Yes, about Pablo, about Fabula, about Gael, about Valparaíso, but we have to be very focused and concentrate with ourselves and with each other.
It feels like you left nothing behind in this film. Like, the dance scenes are intense. Those arguments, I think it stressed me out just watching it. What was it like to sort of take on such an intense role like that, and to, you know, your face dominates nearly every single scene, your dialogue is putting characters down, raising people up. What's that kind of like to take part in?
It was very challenging and exigent. It's my first movie in a main role. I think it's my first movie. I've only done some small roles. It requires a lot of concentration. I don't know. It was intense and it was beautiful. I'm very grateful. Paul is such an amazing director. Gael is such an amazing partner. Santiago. Valparaíso, it's a beautiful scenery, landscape. Yes, but it was very challenging.
What was it like to work with Gael on this as well? That you're quite the pairing in this film. I mean, your arguments that you have, like, I love the dialogue. What was that like to sort of do those scenes together?
Gael is very generous.
Humble.
He is a very nice person, and we work as a team. And yes, we said all these mean things to each other. But I think that they love each other after all. And they passed through this terrible thing, return a child, and he said to her in a dialogue, we have to stick together for at least 2 years.
I love that bar scene. That was fantastic.
I love that bar too. It's
And finally, what was it like working with Pablo? Like, Jackie, for example, was one of my favourite films of the year it came out. What did it feel like to be that he's got this follow-up film, that you're the lead of it? You know, did that come with a pressure and excitement to be the lead in one of his films?
All of that. Pressure, excitement. He's very sensitive. I love this. His films. El Club is my favourite. He puts his eye where no one else does. I don't know if he loves, but he retrata.
He depicts.
He picks up dark places. For example, in adoption, no one talks about failed adoption. The ugly side of adoptions. He's very exigent. He's very sensitive.
Sensitive.
He's an amazing director. I learned a lot. I think that maybe, hopefully, he learned from me too.
Absolutely, perfect. Thank you so much. All the best with the film. It was a real pleasure.
Gracias, thank you.
We're on the red carpet next with Steve Coogan and a variety of the cast members of Greed, Michael Winterbottom's latest film, a comedy satire about a retail billionaire's 60th birthday party that's celebrated in an exclusive hotel on the Greek island of Minkos.
He was ostensibly dislikable, but he was entertaining, he was witty, and sometimes charismatic people can be not very nice people. And so the combination of those things are what made me want to play him. It's I mean, most of the things, a lot of the things that are said in this film are direct quotes from Sir Philip Green. So it's very like real world. You know, a lot of the scenes in it have happened in real life before. The garment workers in the film play themselves. They are real garment workers. They're not actors. The Syrian refugees in the film are played by real Syrian refugees, not actors. So the film is already half real.
Hi there. So obviously you're a Greek actor. Most of the film is set in Greece. What do you think of how it reflects the challenges that Greece face in the film? That you see workers being exploited, the challenges, Syrian refugees kind of moving into Greece. What was it like for yourself to be involved in a project like this?
Yes, obviously I knew to start with that it was a comedy, which is great, but at the same time I knew that we are bringing to the surface a topic that's extremely important and the biggest problem that Greece is facing for the last few years. Morally, it's a very, very difficult decision. We're talking about a country that financially is recovering from a massive recession and suddenly is getting lots and lots of refugees, most of them illegal, coming to the island. Of course they can't keep them out because humanity is first, but at the same time it's very, very hard to sustain that. So the fact that the film brings a wider awareness of the issue is extremely important, and I feel very passionate about that part of the film.
So Steve Coogan is one of our kind of longest serving actors, comedic actors here in the UK. How do you sort of prepare and research to get in the mindset of a young Steve
Coogan?
You bite
your nails loads. Yeah. Shit yourself. No, it's what do you do? You kind of have to separate from it, I think, and I think that's what I did, and was quite easy because obviously we didn't work together at all. We were very separate and had to create our own kind of separate things. I think the Richard that I play is very different to the Richard that Steve plays, because the man changes, you know. And I think that was a decision that we made really, really early on. We didn't want it to be like a caricature or like an impersonation or anything like that. But it was scary but exciting.
Excellent. Thank you very
much. Thank you.
Finally, on opening night of the film festival, we were on the red carpet for the personal history of David Copperfield, Armando Iannucci's latest film, with actors Dave Patel, Morryford Clark, and co-writer Simon Blackwell.
You know, the issues that Dickens writes about before anyone, you know, mental health, dyslexia, that's what David had.
Class
struggles and status, the idea of, the 1% abusing their power over their majorities, and the idea that, the underdogs have to band together in order to achieve something. And this strength in numbers, there's so much to it. I see Dickens when I film in India, I see Dickens in London, I see it everywhere. I hope that it's a really buoyant, joyous movie. It's got an amazing cast, that's the British. And it's amazing that the festival's embracing it this way. And it just shows that we've got some amazing films that can make out here.
Thank you.
Cool.
Hi there, Simon. Obviously, you're one of our best writers here in Britain at the moment. Academy Award nominated as well, so it's not just my opinion. What's it like going from writing original content, characters and films to adapting something like Charles Dickens? What are the pitfalls and the pros of doing something like that?
I think you need to want to get the spirit of the book onto the screen. There needs to come a point where you need to stop being incredibly reverent about it, because you need to be able to play with the story. And so hopefully it's a balance of respecting the text and making it your own. But we both love the book, Armando and I, and we both love the comedy in it. And that was our jumping off point, really.
Perfect, thank you. And how do you go around detaching yourself from that, knowing what to cut, what to keep? Is that a challenge, or is that something that's quite liberating?
Working with Armando, the process is always you cut kind of 95% of what you write. That's been what it was like on The Thick of It and on Veep and on everything we've done. Once, as a writer, your instinct is to be terrified of that. But once you accept it, it is the most liberating thing, because everything can change, everything's in flux. You've never locked a script, you're always creating it. And it's the most creative thing way of working you can as a writer.
Perfect. Thank you so much. All the best tonight, Simon. So obviously, in addition to the personal history of David Copperfield, you're also in the fantastic St. Maud. What's it like to bring both films to the festival? I've seen you three times in three different roles across two films today.
Yeah, I can't believe that it's happened. I feel so lucky to have it in London, where those of my friends and family live as well. Because I feel that, kind of feel like nothing ever happened until someone you know sees it. You're like, how does this feel? But also, can I say, Eternal Beauty is here, directed by Craig Roberts, and that's also, he's a genius. I think that what means that David can get through a world that is hard and cruel is because he had that love from his mother at the beginning. And I think that once kind of this darkness of the Murdstones comes into his life and he's sent away, he's always searching for that. And I think he does meet someone who just has a little bit of an essence of not his mother, but the love and safety that he once had. So I really like that he did that. But I actually only auditioned for Dora and then arrived for just, was sent to meet Armando. And he was like, I'd like to play Clara and Dora. And then had to keep my screaming internal for the next hour while I chatted to him. But yeah, I really like it because I think that my mum has worked a lot with children and she says that being loved is so important. We need to value it, like that protects us from things. So I think that, yeah, Clara is very significant in his ability to come. Yeah.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.